guys, what's up? This is Sarah Troutman, and you might notice that we have a new name. It's Defy. So why did we change the podcast title? We changed the podcast title because when I was talking to the team of incredible individuals that I work with, we realized we don't care about fitting into societal or professional norms. We defy them. And that's really been the theme of all of the guests that we've had on this podcast. So why don't we just call a spade? And that's what we're all about, defy. Is this a show about perfection? Nah, because that doesn't exist. Is this a show full of empty self-help quotes for you to put on your Instagram? Hell no, that ain't our style. This is a show about defying the norms because well-behaved women rarely make history. So come on, babe, come defy with us and learn how you can use the power of behavioral science to live an amazing life. Well, now I'm having to think of like something like really professional to say. I'm not going to be professional. I'm just going to be like, yo, this is my friend Katie Carruthers. Katie Carruthers, what's up?
Hi, I'm good. I mean, yeah.
You're like, it's, you know, December, it's COVID. Also, I know that you're still recovering from a medical procedure from last week, so which had like unexpected complications in terms of your recovery. But what people cannot see, and I'm pretty excited about, is one of my favorite dogs of Facebook and Instagram, Rilo, which is your dog, is sitting behind you right now. So this brings me tremendous joy to see Rilo IRL because I am very avid follower and commenter on all of the activities of Rilosaurus and everyone in your house. So let's talk about for just a few minutes how we know each other. And I want to say, how did we meet like 5 or 6 years ago, Katie? How long is it been?
I was thinking about it because when you were the chair, you were the co-chair for Calaba with Ellie. Mm-hmm. And so that was a long time ago. It was one of my last years as the volunteer coordinator. And mm-hmm. we were working together then. That was like more of like our formal working together and down when we were in San Diego for the Calaba conference.
Was that 5 conferences ago? We were just talking before we started recording this that like time has lost all meaning, especially in this pandemic. And so, you know, Katie, before it was prepping, we prepped for this podcast and you were just saying even like going along the timeline of all of your experiences with your migraines, you're like, oh my gosh, I really had to like sit down and think like, when did this actually happen? So yeah, I mean, I think it was so that's like maybe 5 Calaba conferences ago. And it's, you know, and I always knew that you were like a great behavior analyst, you know, you have so much energy, you're so organized because you were able to, you know, coordinate all of these like student volunteers for this very large conference. And like, let's be real, coordinating like student volunteers is like herding cats. It's very challenging. And this is a conference, just for people that don't understand, the California Association for Behavior Analysis Conference is the second largest conference in the behavior analytics space in the world. And so this past year, we had to cancel it on site because of COVID. And that can be its whole own podcast episode. But there's, you know, like 3,000 people that come and tons of vendors and sponsors and lots of presentations, activities. And so we need volunteers to help, you know, support everything going on with the conference, also to help kind of keep our costs down. And so, you know, Katie, kind of like thanklessly, how many years were you volunteer coordinator?
It was 4 or 5 years. The first one was 2012. And the first year I did it was actually the first year that Calaba experienced the kind of unexpected growth. So it was the mm-hmm. first year that we really met capacity and we're shutting doors and saying, you know, sorry, you know, this room is full and the fire marshal says only this.
And then everyone gets angry. Everyone is angry and they're all angry at these student volunteers who are these like little doe-eyed youngins. And so Katie was always really great about like training them. And then also I applaud you for your firm but compassionate boundaries because you had to model appropriate professional behavior all the time for people that were like angry about not getting into their session. So you were just like such a rock star. But you reached out to me when I first started doing this podcast for a really different reason. And I actually had no idea that you had been dealing with this like chronic condition for so long. And once we started talking about it, I literally think like every like second word was like, what? That's insane. What are you talking about? Like, this is crazy. And so I want to talk about your battle with hemiplegic migraines. I had to look these up. When you're like, hey, I suffer from hemiplegic migraines, I was like, oh, my partner Jay suffers from migraines. Like, they're super crappy. I totally get it. And you're like, girl, no, this is like some old, whole other shit. So can you explain to everyone, what is a hemiplegic migraine?
Yeah, I think that in a lot of ways, the migraine condition I have is very similar to other people in the terms of the pain. Mm-hmm. The pain is really where the similarities, the part that makes it unique and rare and, you know, maybe not heard of is the what's called an aura. So an aura in of itself, when you come to migraine, is not, you know, that unusual. People do get what's called like a visual aura. So they'll say, oh, I've got blurred vision or I see squiggly lines. And that's not that rare, you know, migraine with aura, you know, that's a diagnosis doctors are familiar with or that people have heard of, or, you know, they know someone with migraine that gets that. With the hemiplegic migraine, what's different is that aura takes on what's called stroke symptoms. And mm-hmm. those stroke symptoms have everything from, you know, the inability to speak, like cotton mouth, apraxia, which is, you know, words, but you're not able to say them, ataxia, the slurred speech or the incoordination, aphasia, where you can't understand speech or you just have like a general confusion, the paralysis on the left side of the body, the facial drooping, you know, the vision loss, and that left-sided weakness. So really, that's why they call them stroke symptoms, is that generally it feels a lot like you're having a stroke. And so that comes on prior to the actual migraine. You get the aura. It's like having a stroke. The aura mm-hmm. goes away, and then the pain sets in after the aura goes away. And that's what HM or hemiplegic migraine is. And we can call it either one today. It's kind okay. of a hard word to say.
The HM, we'll call it the HM because I love acronyms. So let's definitely call it that. So everything that you just described to me sounds terrifying. And then what's even more terrifying is you were only 16 the first time that you experienced this. What happened?
So I was 16 and I was at what's a band review. So a band review is where you have I was in the marching band and you go with all the other marching bands and you march down the street like a parade and there's people, mm-hmm. you know, it's like a parade, but there's judges and they review you and they score you and they give you like trophies and medals and it's a lot of fun. I was in high school, I was 16, and I was the majorette for the marching band. So the majorette is the baton twirler. Mm-hmm. So like,
I'd like a visual. Do you have pictures of this? Because I'd like to see one.
Yes. Yes, I did. I tracked down pictures because I was like, oh, you know, remembering the first time I was like, oh yeah, that was like leotard status. Like, so we were at a band review on the coast. And so my family we were all staying on the coast and my mom dropped us off. And if you've never been kind of involved in marching band, basically you have like 150 teenagers that are, you know, kind of going crazy before, you know, they might be half naked and they're getting dressed and they're running around and, you know, somebody's like, where's my clarinet? And it's just like total chaos, right? It's, you yeah. know, there's no, it's like that phrase you used earlier. It's like herding cats doesn't even touch this. It's like 150, mm-hmm. you know, 16-year-olds.
Well, it's and like herding cats that are like hopped up on like hormones.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably sugar and like, you know, energy drinks or whatever.
Yeah. So my mom dropped us off because we had some friends that were also in the band with us. And so everyone kind of goes their own way. And I was standing there and my hair and makeup was done. I remember that, but I wasn't in my little spandex leotard yet. And that was the only thing I had to do was put on my leotard. And I was standing in the midst of kind of all of this chaos. And I was standing in front of a bus. And I remember smelling like the fumes of the bus really, really strongly. And I was like, oh, this is weird. Maybe I'm just standing in a weird place. And I kind of move. And then I have like this sense of doom. Like the only thing in my mind is something is wrong. Something mm-hmm. is wrong. Something is wrong. And I'm standing there and I'm looking around and I find one of my friends and I kind of drag them to the bathroom with me. And we were in this like outlet mall parking lot. So you can imagine like kind of disgusting bathroom. And like, as soon as I get in the bathroom, I lean against the wall and I just like slide to the floor and I'm like, something's wrong. Like I can't move. So, and that's just the dialogue that I have. Like something's wrong. Something's wrong. I think it's kind of similar to when they talk about like when you're having a heart attack and there's like that impending sense of doom. Like that was mm-hmm. probably my first like symptom I ever had was that it was just like, this isn't all right. My friend, she went off to use the bathroom or something. I'm not really sure where she went, but I was sitting on like this like cold tile, like disgusting bathroom floor, like couldn't move. And I'm just like, I guess I got to call my mom. I got to go home. I got to leave. And that's like a really big thing. Like I'm the majorette for the marching band. I'm like the person that goes in the front, that twirls. I love this. This is my whole life is like marching band and doing this. And so I get a hold of a phone. I don't even know where I got the phone from because, you know, this is before maybe cell phones were as popular. This is a long
It's okay.
Time
you don't
ago.
Have to out your age, but you can just say it may have been a dial-up phone and that's fine.
Yeah. This is almost 20
a
years.
A landline.
Yeah. Yeah. This is almost 20 years ago. Just about 20 years ago. And so I find a phone. I call my mom. I swear to God, she was there like a second later. I don't know if I like blacked out or what. So she picks me up and she's really concerned, you know, cause she's like, you know, this is your thing. Like you would never, you know, never just want to go home and not do this. This isn't normal. And so we get back to our friends at a beach house and we were staying at. And so we get back to the beach house and pretty much as soon as I got in, the nausea came, the kind of like feeling of dread or the impending doom lifted and the pain came. Mm-hmm. And so I got back to the house and the pain came. And I asked my mom, you know, I was trying to prepare for this podcast. And I was like, oh, mom, like, what do you remember about this first migraine I had? And she's like, well, you know, I just had this like really healthy, nothing is wrong, you know, bouncing teenage daughter who went from like perfect health to incapacitated. And so the pain came and it was there for a couple hours. My parents tried like feverishly to figure out what was wrong. You know, everything they would give me, a drink of water, I would throw it up, any medication, throw it up. And it was hours and hours of this pain. And then eventually, you know, the pain went away. And that was kind of that first migraine experience.
So then after that happened, did you like automatically, you know, go to like your general practitioner that referred you to a neurologist or how were you more formally diagnosed?
So I think I had a couple more migraines. I think that first one was a little bit, you know, my folks weren't really like, oh, let's run to the doctor. I think they kind of were like, oh, it's migraine. My uncle had migraine. I think they spoke to him and they're like, okay, this is just migraine. And so I had a couple more migraines and the stroke symptoms were setting in pretty hard at that point. I had had full left side paralysis. And then migraine, I had had cotton mouth. I know I'd had those symptoms. And then I did go to my regular doctor and they kind of looked me over and we talked about the symptoms and they were like, oh yeah, I just remember they were super nonchalant. They were just like, oh yeah, it's migraine. And I was like, what about, you know, this paralysis or, you know, I can't move my body. And they're like, oh, migraine with aura. That's all this is. It's just complex migraine. And they sent me in for an MRI and everything was clear. And they gave me some medication to take. And that was kind of that initial diagnosis at 16. And at that point, I got them about every 2 months before 9 a.m. They're very regulated. And so the doctor was just not super concerned and was like, yeah, this like this is normal that this 16-year-old, you know, just, you know, drops to the floor and,
right.
you know, and can't speak and
do anything. Sure.
Yeah.
And so did you feel like, I mean, did you feel like the doctor was like not was like minimizing your experience or were they just like not understanding at that point, like the complexity of what was going on or recognizing it, that it was really a hemiplegic migraine? Did they just like how did they miss this is what I'm wondering.
So I grew up in a small town and I think small town doctors, you know, just, they know their patients really well and they, you know, sometimes there's maybe an overconfidence of, you know, it wouldn't be anything rare. Mm-hmm. You know, it just must be this normal thing. There might've been a little bit of looking at, you know, this teenage girl and going, oh, you know, is that really what's happening? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, you know, they didn't even send me to a neurologist to be honest. And I actually did not hit a neurologist until 2015.
Oh my gosh. I didn't realize that. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so, I think one thing though about their confidence was that it gave me like a lot of confidence in it. Like I was never afraid. Like I would be sitting, it was always my US history class for 1 year because like they would hit at the same time. So I was always in like US history. And I remember like sitting there and then like the back of my neck would go numb and then like my arm would be, you know, I couldn't move it. It'd be paralyzed. And I would just like really calmly be like, oh, okay, I'm getting a migraine. And the thing I was most worried about, honestly, was getting home before the nausea and the pain set in. Like that was my whole biggest fear. I was like, oh, I don't want to throw up at school.
Sure.
You know, I wasn't worried about like, oh, will I ever be able to use my arm again? Or like, you know, am I actually having a stroke? I think the doctor's like nonchalance about it made me very like, oh, that's just what it is. Like, that's, it's not a big deal. I don't know that I realized, because this is 20 years ago too, before the internet is what it is now. And I don't know that I even realized how like rare it was, because they just had so quickly said, oh yeah, this is the thing. I talked to people who got migraines, but I was a teenager. And so I think that I just didn't have a lot of contact with like the migraine community at that point.
Yeah. So you know, you're in high school, you're having these like pretty regularly. And so you just kind of learned to live with it.
Yeah. They were really regulated. So they were every other month before 9 a.m. And then I would kind of like check it off. Like, okay, I'm not going to like get one for another 2 months. The auras were extremely 20 to 30 minutes. They would stop. Nausea would set in. I would start vomiting and then the pain would come. And then I had some medication that they gave me and I would take the medication at that time. So I think it was just this like part of my life, and I was busy, you know, like I said, I was obsessed with marching band. I did color guard and winter guard, and I played lots of sports and I did lots of clubs. And so I think I was just really busy. And this was just kind of just this, another little part of my life that didn't super impact me, to be honest. You know, one day every couple months I would be out.
Yeah. And you're like, I can deal with that. It's no big deal. But then something happened in 2013 where it became a really, really big deal.
Yeah. So when I went to college, so I was 16 and then I went to college and they dwindled away. Like, I got them maybe once a year, maybe every other year when I was in college and graduate school. Yeah. So they were like kind of gone. And honestly, because of, they were so low frequency, I would get one and it was just like, oh, okay, this is a migraine. I'm going to get over it. I mean, it hurt a lot and it was really painful and it was awful, but I think I was just so used to them at that point. And then they would go away for like a year and then I would get another one. So I had a really low frequency of migraines from, you know, I started college in 2004. And so until 2012, I really didn't have a lot of them. And then the resurgence came in 2013. And what happened was this HM, or this hemiplegic migraine, it really changed form and it changed its shape. And so that was what I think I didn't even realize, that it was getting so bad because it didn't look like it used to look.
Mm-hmm. So what did it look like?
So when I was a teenager and when I would get them, there was a 20 to 30 minute aura. You know, you have the paralysis or the facial drooping or the inability to speak or cotton mouth. And then it would stop altogether after about 20, 30 minutes. The nausea would hit and then the pain would come right after it. And the pain would last several hours. And it was awful. You know, you'd be throwing up. You'd be trying to take medication, doing the whole migraine dance. In 2013, what started to happen was that the stroke symptoms or the aura came on and they didn't go away. So I was having like a symptom like cotton mouth, which is where your tongue is kind of like paralyzed and you can't, you know, you can talk and you can think very, like very clearly, but it definitely, you're definitely impaired to other people. So when you try to talk to them, you know, it sounds like you're not moving your tongue. And so I had that particular symptom one time. I woke up, you know, I could feel the numbness on the back of my neck. I spoke to my husband and, you know, I was like, oh, okay, I'm getting a migraine. Probably emailed work or something and said, I'm not going to be in today. He went off to work and I waited for the pain to come. You know, just like, okay, I got my medicine. You know, I'm getting ready and it's not coming. And now it's been 6 hours and I'm like talking to myself, you know, because you can't, you know, there's not anyone to talk to and I can hear it. And so I call the doctor's office and they can hear me immediately. So I get the receptionist and then I swear 1 second later, the doctor's on the phone, you know, he's like, hello, you know, Catherine. And, and I'm talking to him and you can hear the impairment and he's like, you need to go to the hospital. And I'm like, oh, I just have a migraine. I just don't know what's going on. Like, this is just a migraine symptom. I've had this so many times. And he's like, no, this might actually be a stroke. You need to go to the hospital, like, right now. And I remember just being very like, no, that's not what it is. This is just migraine. Like, you don't understand. And of course, I sound super impaired. And so anyway, long story short, I do get into the hospital and they're like, you know, do all the EKGs and the CT scans and all of that stuff. And they say, you know, yeah, this is just complex migraine. And again, another doctor just like, this is totally normal. Like mm-hmm. who doesn't lose the ability to speak for 6 hours?
And, yeah. Like whatever, just like deal with it. Yeah.
it's just, and that was what I feel like I was approached with for a lot of my life was, you know, doctors just being like, yeah, you have migraine with aura, you have complex migraine. And like, it was just this really normal thing. And what I've definitely learned over the years is like HM, hemiplegic migraine, is extremely rare. And, you know, this is something that doesn't really happen to people that often.
Yeah. What is the, I mean, do you know off the top of your head what the rate of diagnosis is in the general population? Like, I know like migraines, I mean, I know a lot of people that have them, but you're the first person I've ever known that has that experiences hemiplegic migraines.
I knew at one point, I do think it's less than 1% of migraine sufferers have the actual HM diagnosis. And it's hard because I think about me going so long without, you know, having the actual diagnosis for it. So there could be people out there that just think, oh, I have migraine. So I think the numbers might be a little skewed, but I think it's less than 1% of migraine sufferers have the actual
that specific type
hemiplegic migraine. Yeah, it's the most rare of all of the migraine that you have vestibular migraines and, you know, just that general complex migraine or regular migraine, and hemiplegic, I think, is the most rare.
So it's like the granddaddy of migraines. So did you finally get actually diagnosed with HM in 2013, or when did that diagnosis happen?
No, so everything started to really ramp up in 2013. I kept having the stroke symptoms for longer and longer. I went through a long period right before my wedding, where my face went numb, and I had the drooping lip and the drooping eye, and I was drooling when I was speaking. And the doctor told me I had Bell's palsy, and I was like, oh, okay. And so I just kind of kept going through my regular doctor, and, it's interesting. I really never was like overly concerned with how often like I couldn't feel my foot or I couldn't feel my arm for 2 days. There was a lot of numbness. There was a lot of these symptoms. The drooling was the worst because especially it was like when it was a warmer season and I would like wear scarves so that when I was working, I could, you know, like dab the drool off of my face as I was like talking to patients and clinicians. And so things just kind of kept getting worse. And then what happened actually is I had this fabulous doctor and then he retired. And so he retired in 2015 and I had to get a new doctor. And I was meeting with him to consult and say like, you know, we were going over my medical record and like, what do you have? And I said, oh, I have migraine with aura. You know, I get the stroke symptoms. And I remember I was like super just like, yeah, I get the stroke symptoms. Like, this is just normal, you know? And his face was just like, what?
No. Yeah.
You know, and he's just, I could tell he was kind of trying to like hold something in. And finally he's just like, this is not normal. You do not have Bell's palsy. He's like telling me like kind of unraveling this confidence that I have in my medical condition. And he's like, you're going to a neurologist. You know, right now. He's like, when was the last time you went to a neurologist? And I was like, never. You know?
Yeah.
I've just always been treated. And he's just like, And so he sent me over to the neurologist. And so I got connected with her. She did, you know, obviously I'd had MRIs multiple, you know, I'd been in and out of the ER a lot. I had a lot of MRIs in my past, but she did new MRIs and scans. She did a lot of testing. And then she brought me in and I'm thinking, okay, she's going to say, oh, complex migraine. And she sits there and she says, you have hemiplegic migraine. And I'm like, what? Like, I've never even heard of that. Like, what is that? And then she just starts talking about this condition. And I swear to God, Sarah, she just started like telling me about my life. Like, she was just like, oh yeah, like, has this happened to you? And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, and this? And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, and then this? And like everything she was saying, she's like, do you have motion sickness? I'm like, yeah, I have really bad motion sickness. She's like, has it gotten worse as we've gotten older? I'm like, absolutely. I can't even like ride in the passenger seat anymore to go to the store. And she just like is labeling all these things about my life. And I'm like, wow, like I didn't know that I was looking for a diagnosis at that point. But when she gave me a diagnosis, it was just like, ding, 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 ding. Like, this is who you are. Like, this is what is wrong. Well, not wrong, but you know, this is what's going on with your body.
Yeah. I mean, and so, cause you were saying, so if that initial, you know, migraine happened at age 16, that was almost 20. So that was like, what, like 2000, 1999, around there.
Yeah.
So you didn't get a diagnosis until 2016. Mm-hmm. That is 16 years later. Mm-hmm. Did you even, because I think with, like, when we're younger, you know, for a variety of reasons, sometimes like there's, it's almost like nice to have like the stupidity of teenage years and like your early 20s when you like don't really honestly recognize like how crappy stuff can be. But did you really like fully understand like how this HM was like really affecting your quality of life? And when you got that diagnosis, did it feel like, I'm trying to kind of put myself in your shoes, and I'm like, on some level, I would think like that would be like relieving, like, oh, like I get it. Or was it just like, was it like confirming and helpful, or was it terrifying, or was it both?
I think that with any new diagnosis, everybody always feels, you know, whenever you don't have a diagnosis, you feel like a little bit like hopeless, right? Because you're like, if you don't know what's wrong, how can you fix it? And yeah. So I definitely think that even though I wasn't really like looking for a cure at that point, all of a sudden I was like, oh, I'm going to get better. Like, oh, they know what it is now. They're going to treat it. And my neurologist, she was wonderful. And I loved her, and she was a great fit for me. She really also like made me feel that way. Like, oh, now we can treat this appropriately, because you haven't been treating it appropriately because you didn't know what it was. And you've been taking the wrong medicine. And so I think there was like this big feeling, because it had gotten pretty bad by that point. You know, I was having them 6-8 times a month at that then. And that's the pain. In terms of those stroke symptoms, they could go on for a week at a time, for weeks at a time. And I was just kind of living with them. You know, I had the left-sided weakness, wouldn't be able to feel my toes. Like I said, I would be drooling. So I'm trying to live like my professional life. And remember, in 2015 too, is when I took on a role of a director, you know, of an agency. And
right. So you're like in a leadership position. Yeah. You're in a leadership position and you're, you know, trying to do that well. And then, you know, at the same time, making sure, like you were saying, like, how am I going to be able to make sure I'm not drooling on myself in the summer because I don't have the scarves? I mean, and those are those kind of like little things that really impact your quality of life.
Yeah. And, you know, and just calling out, you know, not being there for meetings, or, you know, when the pain comes, obviously you're not at work. So then making up that work, and it had gotten really bad. So I think honestly, the diagnosis, I wasn't expecting a diagnosis. I thought she was just going to be like every other doctor and say, oh, you have migraine, this is what it is. But when she gave it to me, I think there was a lot of hope that came with it. Like, okay, I'm going to get better. Great. And I think at that point, because I was a workaholic, because I was such a, you know, just perfectionist, check it off my list, it was like, great. Okay. Now I have a diagnosis. Let's get down to fixing it and move on. Yeah. And there was a lot of feeling of like, let's just get better right now and move forward so that I could like get on with my life.
Yeah. And so one of the like greatest things that has happened was the opportunity that you had to be treated at Kaiser's pain clinic in 2017. When we were talking about this, one of the things that I was so stoked about, and I'd love for you to kind of share with everybody, is how acceptance and commitment therapy was part of your treatment package.
Yeah, absolutely. So before I got to Kaiser, so 2015, I got diagnosed. I went to Kaiser in late 2016. Basically in that year between there, So this neurologist that diagnosed me, she got me a treatment team. I had a neurologist, I had a nutritionist, I had an allergist, I had all of these people working, and I loved them, and they were great people. They were great doctors. They all made me feel like, you know, we are here for you. We're going to help you get through this, but they were not working together. So this is before I was with Kaiser. So they were very separate. You know, I would go see one of them and it was like that one person was treating me in their own special way. And then I would like go to the nutritionist and they would kind of change things. And I didn't really recognize that at the time. I just was like so happy to have, you know, four people that cared that I was suffering. And I was excited to have their care. And I enjoyed their visits and their treatment, but I really wasn't getting better. I was actually getting a lot worse. I was going from about 6 migraines a month to 8 migraines a month to 10 migraines a month. And I was taking data, but it was getting worse. And it was interesting because even though I was taking data, I think because I didn't have any treatment goals, you know, I would just go in. I just had this general goal of like, I'm going to get better. I'm going to wake up one day and not have this anymore.
Yeah. You're like, what is that? How do we operationally define getting better? What is better? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I was really put through the ringer with this treatment team though. They put me on medications that made me incredibly sick. I was put on one medication that I lost 30 pounds in 1 month. I, you know, had medications that I had bruising all over my body. My quality of life was diminishing. Everything was about diets. Everything was about lifestyle. All of this stuff was, and it was incredibly intense changes too. And it was always like, this is going to do it, you know, this medication or this dietary change or, but nothing really was getting better. And it was interesting because I think because we're behavior analysts and we know, you know, treatment integrity and we have to do it. I was doing everything to 100% fidelity. Mm-hmm. I was getting worse. And yet I was just kind of like neutral in my position about getting worse. Like, I think there was just this weird, like, acceptance of, you know, maybe I'm just meant to be sick forever. Like, I'm not going to get better. And, you know, that even though there was some acceptance there, I think my mental state was really deteriorating quite a bit.
Yeah.
So I switched to Kaiser. What happened was my work, I had a wonderful relationship with my boss, and she had been with Kaiser for a long time, I think through like her husband's insurance. Mm-hmm. But she came to me and she said, hey, we're going to start offering Kaiser. I think you should consider switching your insurance to Kaiser, because she knew all about my yeah. you know, kind of journey at that point. And I was like, oh, you know, I have like 5 doctors, you know, I see them all the time. How could I possibly like switch my care? And she said, I think you're going to get a more collaborative approach with mm-hmm. Kaiser. And I was like, okay. And honestly, I kind of took a look at the data. And as much as I loved all those doctors, I was like, well,
I'm not getting better.
I'm not getting better. And I think I'd lost a little bit of that hope because they had mm-hmm. said, you know, we're going to make you better. And it had been a year and a half and I wasn't better at all. I was worse. And so I was like, okay, what could it hurt to change? And so I went over to Kaiser in late 2016. And I was lucky because when you go to Kaiser, they're like, pick a doctor. And mm-hmm. they give you like 1,000 doctors.
A cornucopia of an array of options. There's so many doctors.
Yeah. And I lived in Sacramento. So like Sacramento, mm-hmm. there's like 1,000 doctors to pick from. And I just like randomly picked this woman to be my doctor. And she was fantastic. She took me in a couple of appointments. And then in about December, she said, you know, how many migraines are you getting? And I was like, you know, a lot. It's like 10 a month, rebound headaches on top of that. Like mm-hmm. I basically am never healthy. And she said, I think you need to go to the Kaiser Pain Clinic. I'm going to put a referral in for you. So I was only with Kaiser for 2 months and they said, you're going to go to the pain clinic. And mm-hmm. I was like, okay. And so January 2017 came along. I was kind of procrastinating on going to following up on this referral, you know, just a lot of time out of work and nothing had worked in the past. Yeah. And then in January 17, I had 15 migraines that month. And I was losing it.
Yeah. Well, of course you're like, I can't, that's incapacitating. That's incapacitating. Like you can't do anything.
Yeah. I basically didn't work that month. I was out. And then I was making up work in the moments I felt good enough to even make mm-hmm. up work. I was making up work. So I'm working kind of 24 hours a day or in pain. It was just like pain or work, no social life. Quality of life is very poor. And I got to a very, very, very dark place at that point. I thought, you know, my career is over. I'm going to have to go on disability. I'm not going to be able to work. I'm never going to have a pain-free day again. There's like this snowball of when you have pain. And I think a lot of people that suffer from chronic pain can relate to that. So mm-hmm. they kind of have a healthy day. They feel great. The world is like sunshine and rainbows. And then the pain comes. And all of a sudden, even the smallest pain, we start to say, oh my God, it's starting again. It's starting again. And we snowball ourselves into like these really, really dark places in terms of mental health.
Yeah.
So I was there. I was, you know, I had been treated by a lot of doctors that I respected. I had never gotten better. I'd switched over to Kaiser. They did this pain management, you know, referral. And I was putting it off going because I thought I really was very hopeless. I didn't think that anything was going to help me. And so when I finally walked in the door of the pain clinic, I didn't think it was going to work. I thought, okay, I'm a clinician. I got to give this 100% treatment integrity. You know, I got to do my best. But honestly, at that point, I didn't really care if I lived or died. I did not care what happened to me. I was in a state of pain so much. I was depressed because I thought I was going to lose, you know, my job. I thought I was just going to spend my life in pain. And I think there was this part of me that was like, okay, we'll do this to 100% integrity. And then when this doesn't work, you know, we need to make some decisions about life and like what it's going to look like moving forward. And mm-hmm. that's how I went into the pain clinic. just hopeless, depressed, and, you know, kind of at the end of it.
But happily, this was ended up being a really beneficial experience. And so just so people understand, I mean, I've been a Kaiser member since I've lived in California, so 21 years, and like, love it or hate it, they do a really good job of coordinating care and working as multidisciplinary and, more importantly, like interdisciplinary teams. And so at this clinic, I mean, you were able to get biofeedback, acupuncture, drug fading, you know, medication changes, and acceptance and commitment therapy.
Yes.
And this proved to be a way much more effective than you had thought it would, it was going to be.
It did. Yeah. So I went in, and so my doctor at the Sacramento Pain Clinic was Dr. Les Araya. So I have to give him a giant shout out because obviously he saved my life. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me and we did kind of our initial assessment. And I can't even imagine the person that he was looking at, honestly, at that point. Mm-hmm. I know I didn't have any hope. I know I was probably trying to kind of put on a big face of like, mm-hmm. I'm going to do the best I can. I remember he kind of lectured me about like, oh, you need to, everything I say, you need to give it like 100%. And then at some point it came up that I was a behavior analyst, and this is the very first appointment. And he said, oh, you know, there's this treatment I'm going to use, and you might have heard of it because you're a behavior analyst. It's called acceptance and commitment therapy. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, and, you know, I've always worked with children with autism. I've never worked, you know, in the mental health field. I had at that point very, very little exposure to ACT. I didn't know anything about it other than, you know, there's a little bit of a divide of people who, you know, went with ACT and people who didn't. And I didn't really know. I even told him that. I said, you know, oh, I don't even have a platform. You know, I'm pretty neutral on the subject. And he was like, okay, well, it's what I'm going to use to treat you. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, cool.
You're like, bring it on.
And I do think that there was a tiny, tiny little fire, like at that moment, like there was like a, this is weird that like the thing I do every day is going to be part of my pain management. And he started treating me, like you said, there was all these other treatments, but he started treating me in the office with ACT. I saw him about every 2 weeks for a long time. And then every 3 weeks, every 4 weeks, every, you know, 6 weeks, every 2 months, every 3 months, every 6 months, until we faded out. And he did use that acceptance and commitment therapy. And one of the things he told me early on is, you know, we're going to get to a point where you're just going to accept that you might, you know, have migraines forever, and, you know, it might get worse, and you might just have them every day. And I was like, what? Like, that's not what my doctors have been saying. My doctors have been saying, you know, you're going to get better, and we're going to fix you, and you're broken, and you have to come out of this. And he's like, no, you have to accept who you exactly as you are, and you have to accept that this is happening. And that's, of course, that acceptance piece of ACT. And it's interesting because once you start going through the acceptance and commitment therapy of pain management, you get better in a lot of ways, and you might have the same number of migraines, but you're still better. So we worked on that. So we worked on ACT. What I was really great is he was very behavioral about his approach. So we would practice in his office. You know, he would say, you know, I want you to do this. And I'd be like, okay. And I'd be like writing my notes. And then I remember I always had to set my notebook down because we would have to practice whatever it was that was the skill. And so we were a couple months in, and we were really, really working on the meditation side, because mindfulness and meditation is a big part of ACT and pain management. And we were working on, we had been working on this for weeks, and we were working on it, and I did my best. And at this point, I'm kind of coming out of my shell, you know, with him a little bit more, and I'm doing my meditation, and I like stop and I look at him, and he's just kind of staring at me, and he's like, you know, Katie, you are trying really hard. And I was like, okay. And he's like, but you suck at meditation. And I'm like, wait, what? I was like, I've been doing this every day. Like you told me to, right?
Yeah, I am like 100%, like total treatment fidelity. Like what the heck?
Yeah. And he's like, I think you need some like outside help on this meditation thing. And I'm like, okay. And so I lived really close to downtown Sacramento, and they had just opened this new co-op. And so I'm like in there shopping, and I see this little flyer on the wall, and it's like learn to meditate. And it's like super, you know, generic or whatever. And I'm like, okay. I like grab it or take a picture or something. And I'm like, I'm going to go to this class. And so right around the corner from the co-op was the Kadampa Meditation Center. And I go in it and you have to take your shoes off and you go in immediately. There's like Buddhist statues and there's a Buddhist nun. And I'm just like, okay, you know, I didn't have a lot of I didn't have any spirituality at that point. And I went in and the nun was there and there was one other woman learning to meditate. And so she like does this introduction class and all this stuff. And at the end, she's like, oh, you know, like what questions do you have? And I'm like, well, you know, I suck at this. Like, I'm just not any good at it, you know, da, 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 da. And she just kind of like looks at me and she says, what if you just accepted that you suck at it? And I'm like, what? Like, why is everybody keep telling me I suck at this? First of all, you know, we're not used to sucking at stuff.
Right.
And so I just fell in love with her in that moment. And so then she said, we're going to do another meditation. And she had a couple, you know, things that I was to do to accept sucking. And it changed my meditation practice in the moment. Like that day, it was different. And I was like, I am coming back to this place forever. And then, and so her name is Choyup. She's not in Sacramento anymore. Unfortunately, she just moved back to New Jersey. But Choyup was the nun there. And her and I went to classes there the whole time, the whole rest of the time I lived in Sacramento, obviously until COVID. And I'm still a part of the Kadampa Meditation Center. They have a kind of a worldwide, you know, temples and all of that stuff. And I'm still a member today. But yeah, that really is what my meditation and mindfulness journey, that's what really got me on board with that. And, you know, my doctor could see it when I would come back. He was like, something's changed. Like, you're actually doing this right now. And I had that help and that support.
So let's talk about then like your current state. So right now you are only experiencing about one migraine a month.
Yep, I am. Sometimes more like one every 6 weeks. So it's going really, I'm doing really, really well. When they do flare up, it's usually pretty predictable. So this summer I moved from Sacramento to the Central Valley. Huge life change. New job, new house, sold our house. My husband has a new job. Everything was changing. So I had like a little flare up there, but everything was very manageable. And then I got back on track to about that one every 4 to 6 weeks. The stroke symptoms are gone. I don't have them anymore. I don't have the, you know, just random drooling, you know, for 2 or 3 weeks, or my can't feel my toes, or my left arm, you know, being too weak to hold me up, you know, in yoga or something. They have pretty much dissipated. They do come on occasionally, but in a shorter amount of time. And then usually that the pain will come.
And something in, you know, we can... You can talk about this or not talk about this, but you wrote it down, so I assume that you're okay to talk about this. Part of one consequence of your diagnosis is that you can't obtain infertility treatment because there is a risk of stroke.
Yes. Yes. So the first time I heard about kind of this risk, I was in college. And just huge shout out to Planned Parenthood. You know, I'm a big supporter of Planned Parenthood and all the awesome stuff they do. So I didn't have health insurance and I was at Planned Parenthood, I think for like the annual exam or something. And we're talking about birth control and they're like, oh, here's your little questionnaire to fill out. And you know how when you go to the doctor, it always says like 40 different conditions. It's like, what do you, you know, do you have asthma? So I clicked migraine. And so they were like, oh, you have migraine. And I said, yeah. And they said, oh, here's your second questionnaire. And I was like, oh, okay. And they were like, do you have any of these symptoms, you know, with migraine? And sure enough, the aura, you know, is there. And, you know, do you have paralysis? Do you have numbness? And, you know, vision impairment. And I'm like clicking every one of them because by that point, you know, I'm 4 years into migraine and I had. And so they came in and they said, you know, you can't have hormonal birth control. You really can't have any hormone treatment because of migraine with aura. There's a big stroke risk. I was like, oh, okay. You know, that's interesting. And then, you know, every doctor I went to after that point always confirmed it. But what was interesting was Planned Parenthood was the only one that really investigated it. So I would go to like a new OBGYN once I had insurance and I would say, you know, I'd click migraine as a box and then they would try to give me like hormonal birth control. And I would be like, oh, whoa, I have migraine with aura. You know, I can't have that. And the doctor would confirm. They'd be like, oh, yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. Migraine with aura. But I thought it was interesting. They never really did that deep diving. Like Planned Parenthood really, you know, checked every box for me. So they were the first one. So I've never been on hormonal birth control. So then about a year and a half ago, we'd been trying to have a baby for about 3 years. And so we had, you know, the like formal testing done. And they said, you know, it's really, really unlikely that you're going to get pregnant naturally. You know, you need to go to IVS, you need to go to infertility. And I remember thinking immediately, like, I don't think I can. Yeah. And so I got a hold of the neurologist. I got a hold of fertility because Kaiser's is, you know, very, you know, all in one. Mm-hmm. And so I got a hold of them. They're emailing each other back and forth. And then my doctor set me down in June of this year. And she was like, you know, you can't have fertility treatments. You can't. Mm-hmm. Your options are surrogacy or adoption. And really, I would prefer adoption for you. Because of the stroke risk of increasing the hormones in my body. And, you know, with this type of HM or migraine, there's just this risk that these stroke symptoms turn into an actual stroke, right? Because you're getting a stroke symptom because your blood vessels are already constricting, right? Mm-hmm. And so we already know that they're constricting. They don't want to put anything in your body that might make that happen even more. Mm-hmm. So we took that information and we were like, okay, wow, big, big surprise. We'd never thought that was going to be us. And so we moved down here to Central Valley and we are now what's called resource parents, which is actually foster parents. Mm-hmm. And we do plan to adopt children from the foster system.
Yeah. Which of course I'm an adoptive mother and you know this obviously. And so I'm, you know, really excited for both of you guys, but I also can imagine, you know, that was pretty heartbreaking. But at the same time, it's like, you know, why take an unnecessary risk with your life? And I guess the way that I've always thought about children is like, gosh, there's so many different ways to make families. And there's, you know, especially now there's so many different, you know, types of families. What a great opportunity. And I think especially with your training as a behavior analyst, and I've definitely, you know, felt like my training as a behavior analyst has helped me, in part too, to be able to deal with some of the, you know, kind of unknown variables associated with adoption, especially when you, you know, depending on the age of child, you know, they might be coming with, you know, traumas and experiences, that, you know, we haven't had experience with and are going to need to be, you know, treated in a different way. And so I'm really excited for you guys. Cause when we talked last month, you actually had a temporary placement. There was a couple kids in your house at that time. And you're like, gosh, we don't know what's going to happen. This, like, literally we got the call like yesterday. Now we have these two kids and, you know, they were able to be placed with a family member. But that's kind of, you know, the kind of excitement in the foster care system is you're like, who knows how this is going to go down.
Yeah, it is. And it's interesting, you know, because like you said, you can have a 2-year-old, you can have a 5-year-old. And, mm-hmm. you know, we know because we're mandated reporters and we have been for our whole career. Like, we know how difficult it is to have a child removed from a home, you know. Yeah. So we know that these kids that are coming in have had experiences that we just have not had a lot of contact with and probably mm-hmm. haven't had a lot of experience with. And it is interesting to see them. And then, you know, our history as behavior analysts now to try to work on communication and work on maybe some more appropriate skills to replace what they've learned mm-hmm. in their traumatic experiences.
Yeah.
It's been a journey for sure. We're new to it. We've only had those two mm-hmm. little ones that we had, you know, for a couple of days there. We're supposed mm-hmm. to have them one night. We ended up having them 5 nights and it was a roller coaster, but we're really excited about whenever we get our next, you know, mm-hmm. child or next set of children.
Yeah. I have a girlfriend of mine, all 3 or 4 kids, were fostered to adopt. And they've all had like such interesting stories and they're all like really neat kids. And it's been, you know, a really special way for them to build their family. I want to talk before we wrap up about, cause you wrote down some really, really good points as it relates to medical advocacy. And yes. I think these are deeply, deeply important. So do you want to just kind of walk through them? Cause these are specifically for women.
Yes, absolutely. I think what was interesting was when we talked and we were like, okay, you know, let's make some talking points for the podcast. And I was like, oh, I definitely want to talk about medical advocacy because it's just such a part of my just normal life with my friends and my like, you know, people will come to me. And so as I started making the points, I was like, wow, there is so much, you know, to know. And I'm a migrainer. So I am a member of like the migraine support groups on social media. And I also, you know, see firsthand kind of the lack of advocacy skills, if you have, you do run into some brick walls, or you don't get treated appropriately, or you get yourself into a bad situation in terms of your treatment. And so, you know, I have become really interested in medical advocacy. I think one of the biggest things is how to talk to doctors, you know, especially when we are a chronic pain sufferer, because when you have chronic pain, you know, you are telling people like, my life sucks. Like, I don't want to get out of bed in the morning, or, you know, I'm throwing up, or I'm missing work, or I didn't get to go to that wedding. And there are a lot of really big things. And I think that one thing that can come across when we're talking to doctors is knowing how to express the level of pain. And every doctor, you may not know this if you're not a chronic pain person, has a pain scale, right? They'll say, where is your pain between 1 and 10? And, you know, the worst thing that we can do when we're talking to a doctor is drive ourselves to the doctor's office and, you know, be sitting there and they say, oh, how bad is your migraine right now? And say, oh, it's a 10. Mm-hmm. You know, bullshit. It's not a 10. Like, you didn't get in your car and drive to the doctor's office. Like, you're passing out if it's a 10, right?
Yeah.
And so really being honest with yourself and being like, okay, this is where my level is. This is how my pain is, and scoring that appropriately. But then on the other end of it, we can be, you know, like I would say more like what I was in 2013 to 2015 of not expressing how bad it is, right? We're just like, oh, no, I'm fine. Just like, make me better. And we like assume that doctors know that when we say we have migraine, or we say we have fibromyalgia, or whatever it is that we're suffering with, we just assume they know how bad it is. And then we're not asserting for ourselves. And we're not saying, hey, I missed 6 days of work this month. Like, I can't continue this. I need something to prevent these migraines from coming on. So really having that balance. And a good way to know how to talk to doctors is having, you know, I say a woman, but a friend in your corner that's not just a yes man, you know, that you don't call up after the doctor and go, oh, I went to the doctor and this is what they say. And they go, oh, that's great. That's great. Or, oh gosh, I can't believe the doctor said that. But somebody that actually is going to sit there and go, wait, what did you say? Okay, I'm not sure if you should have said it like that. Or what did the doctor say? What exactly did they say? And somebody that can help you critically think. And it might not be your mom, and it might not be your best friend. It might be
because it's like they're too biased. You need someone that's going to be willing to give you like really direct feedback.
Yeah, they're too mama bear for you. So having like a woman in your corner or a friend in your corner that can help you navigate the doctor. Women with migraine tend to not be heard, you know, and I think some of it comes from the exaggeration. You know, if a doctor's hearing you say, you know, oh, it's always a 10 when I'm at work, or it's always an 11, you know, they're not going to believe those things. But at the same time, I think there's just a history of not believing women. And, you know, this is something that it's interesting. If you read about migraine a little bit, a lot of the kind of disclaimers at the bottom of WebMD or those medical pages will say, you know, yes, you might get headache every day and it might be ruining your life, but guess what? You're not going to die because of migraine. It's like, that's supposed to make you feel better, right? Right. Like, oh yes, you get a migraine every day, but you're not going to die from it, right? It's not cancer.
Yeah, but you're like, but is this living? Do you know what I mean? Like, that's the other side of it. Like, right. I'm like technically alive, but am I living if I am in like constant pain that is affecting my quality of life every single day?
Absolutely. And so I think what happens with doctors, though, is because it's not going to kill you, they're maybe not as motivated to treat you or to admit you to the hospital or to get you that care. And I think that might be true for all chronic pain, not just migraine sufferers. I really, really advocate to take data. I know it's hard to take data, especially in the moment when you're starting to pop pills and it's like all you care about is the pain reduction, but what medications you're taking. One thing that's interesting with doctors is that they don't speak like behavior analysts. And that's not a criticism. It's just a difference between the way that we talk. And I've learned that doctors, neurologists, whoever it is, they're not going to sit with you and look at your pretty little graph and be like, oh, I had 8 in June and 3 in November, right? They are going to say, how many migraines are you getting right now? And you have to answer on the spot. You have to say, I'm getting 8 a month. How bad is it? Well, I missed 4 days of work. I can't sleep at night, right? They're about, you know, they are getting up to a 7 or 8. I went to the emergency room twice. You have to really be able to speak at a moment's notice to doctors and be able to say your pain. And as behavior analysts, we want to show the graph and the history and the pattern and say, but this was the end. I think this is what triggered it and this and that. We have to kind of leave a little bit of that behind, be really, really familiar with our data and be able to just speak in very concise
and be succinct.
To doctors.
Yeah. And then you also, a couple other things you talked about is evaluating what is your real expectation of treatment and what are your treatment goals?
Absolutely. And that's something I learned from the pain clinic. So that my pain doctor had goals for my treatment way before I did, right? He was a little bit different doctor. So he was looking at data and graphs and saying, oh, you're having 8 a month or this intensity, this just triggers. But when you go to the doctor, you can't just go in and be like I was and say, I just don't want to have migraine anymore, right? Well, do you want a prevention medication? Do you want a new rescue medication? Like, what are you asking for? Is the medication you're using working? So you have to go in knowing that, right? Is the medication you take when you get a migraine ineffective? Does it have bad side effects? Are you missing, you know, are you sleeping for 30 hours when you take it and you would like something that doesn't make you sleep for 30 hours? You have to pinpoint that before you go to the doctor. Doctors don't know what you're asking for, and that's not their fault, right? You need to be able to be concise with them and say, hey, you know, is there a different prevention medication I can take? This one, you know, has made me lose 30 pounds, mm-hmm. you know, in a month. I'm not eating. And so being able to talk to doctors and say, you know, can I try a different prevention medication? Can I have a different rescue med? And then what's your goal? And honestly, being able to wait for these medications to work, you know, yeah. because we don't want to ever have another migraine again. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we're not going to go from 8 to 0. You know, right. we're going to have to go from 8 to 7 to 8 to 6. Mm-hmm. It is a long process.
And then the last thing that you talked about is read, and then maybe just read some more because you need to learn about your condition and don't believe every word that you read, but get educated.
Absolutely. So read about what they're recommending for you. Read about the treatments they're recommending for you. I read 8 books about meditation before I ever meditated once. You know, mm-hmm. I didn't believe everything in every book. You know, read about your chronic condition, read about migraine, but, you know, remember too that anyone can write a book and anyone can be published, and it doesn't mean that they are an MD in that area. Do your research on who you're believing, mm-hmm. but really do educate yourself on what the doctors are saying to you so that when you're popping those pills or you're doing some kind of crazy new treatment, you know, that you do believe in it or that you know enough about it to believe in it. And you're not just kind of blindly following what somebody said.
And you referenced 2 books, and I'm going to put these in the show notes because I want to read them for initial acceptance. And one is from Byron Katie. It's Loving What Is. And the other one is from Tony Bernhard, How to Be Sick. And you yes. found both of these books to be really helpful for you.
Yeah. Byron Katie's one of my absolute all-time role models. She still practices her. So what she has is she has a way of getting you to a point of acceptance. It's very behavioral. She mm-hmm. has little worksheets. Everything is free. You can go to her website, watch webinars. You can watch her online all the time, working with people through really, really traumatic experiences. She's fantastic. She's lovely. She lives over there in the kind of by you over in the Bay Area. Oh. Yeah. And so she lives over there. So she still gives, when it's not COVID, she still gives seminars out there in San Rafael. And she's fantastic. And what I love about her is that a lot of meditation books that you read, they'll say, oh, just accept it. Like, just do this, just do that. And what mm-hmm. ACT does, of course, is it breaks it down and it helps teach you how behaviorally
to accept how it. Do you do it? Right. Yeah.
And right. And Byron Katie does too. I think Byron Katie just really has that, you know, non-judgmental approach to accepting what's going on in your life. And then Tony Bernhard, mm-hmm. She's actually out of Davis, and she wrote that book, How to Be Sick. She has a chronic condition where she is sick every day of her life. And she has a wonderful book about just really accepting, you know, being sick.
Yeah. And then finally, what you talked about is, you know, and this is something that I think if you have a chronic condition or not, I think people don't do enough of is self-care. You know, and you wrote about how to, you know, live your best life when you're not in pain, you know, work on coping skills and adopting coping skills that aren't in opposition to pain management, such as drinking.
Yes.
And I think that is really important. I mean, because I think for so many people, they're like, let me just numb myself out. And that's not necessarily going to yield the kind of positive results. To make sure that you're engaging in rest and restoration, value-based living. And then for you, a huge piece of this has been your meditation practice and mindfulness.
Yes. Yes, it has been. And learning to do that and do that when you feel good. Because, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of your prevention is, you know, as you know, exercising and eating well is mm-hmm. prevention to not feel bad later. And yeah. so it's hard though. When you feel good, you just want to go out and do all those things that make you feel good, like, you know, hang out with your friends or go shopping. But you do have to also have that meditation, the exercise, the mm-hmm. healthy eating, even when you're feeling fabulous. mm-hmm. Wow. And I think really the support groups, you know, circle of friends, your relationships, yeah. making sure you're talking to people about what's going on with you and And not being afraid, you know, to just say, you know, I have friends that I literally text and we have a little emoji that means I have a migraine and I'll send it. And then I'll be like, I'm dying, you know, mm-hmm. and it's the most dramatic, you know, the most ridiculous things I'll say to them. And they just know, and they're just there for me in that moment. And they know, obviously I'm not dying, but they know how to respond really well. And you have to find that. And, you know, if you're keeping all of this hidden and you're not talking about it, then you know, you're not going to build on your support group and your circle of friends. And there are so many people out there that want to come in and be there for you. And it mm-hmm. might be surprising if you just kind of open up to them and say, I'm suffering, you know, I'm really having a hard time.
Yeah. And I feel like, this year has definitely been one of those years where people have recognized like there's no point in doing this alone and you don't have to. And when you can, you know, be brave and put yourself out there, it can sometimes be surprising that, you know, right away people are like, yeah, like, oh, me too. Or like, how can I support you? And you might not even know that those people were paying attention. But if you don't give people the opportunity to respond, then you'll never know.
Yes, so. Absolutely. And just telling people what's going on, you know, don't keep it hidden. mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, this is so awesome. I mean, and as soon as you reached out to me and we started, you know, talking about this, I was like, oh my gosh, Katie, this is also just so important. Because I likely think that, you know, a consequence of putting this podcast out is we're going to get a lot of feedback of like, oh my gosh, I've been suffering from this too. And, you know, I didn't know what to do. And these are, you know, I love the fact that I think because you're a behavior analyst, have approached this and, you know, even recording this in like such a systematic way to not just talk about your story and be honest and open, but really talk about strategies that people can use that are effective to help them alleviate suffering, unnecessary suffering.
Absolutely. And
I love the, you know, I wish I knew like your meditation kind of guru. Cause I love the fact that she was like, well, why don't you just accept that you like suck at meditation? You're like, what?
You're supposed to be teaching me.
Yeah. But you're like, oh, wait. But like, if I can just kind of accept it, then I can kind of release it. And then I actually might be able to get good at it because like, I'm not like worried about it anymore, you know?
Yeah.
So thank you. And like I said, I'm going to, you know, tag a bunch of resources in the notes for this podcast because again, like I know part of our goal together talking about this is just to really try to bring, you know, awareness, understanding, help, hope. For people that may also be suffering from chronic pain conditions in just kind of not knowing where to go. So.
Absolutely. And that's where I've been wanting to tell my story for a long time. I'm so excited to be the like voice of migraine for the podcast. I know that it's a huge issue. And, you know, there are a lot of women in behavior analysis. Migraine does typically affect women more than it does men. Men suffer as well, but it affects women. And I'm excited that maybe if somebody heard something today and they can reach out to me and I can help them with the medical advocacy or, you know, this, what is this ACT thing? What is this, mm-hmm. you know, pain clinic? I have Kaiser, you know, and so that mm-hmm. I can kind of help them too. And I'm very excited to do that. And I'm excited to hopefully instill some hope in people that are, you know, 2016 Katie right now, who might be listening, who are, you know, waiting for the cure, waiting for the day that they don't have migraine anymore. And hopefully they can hear this and go, wow, this is a complicated journey, but it is a journey. And mm-hmm. now I'm at a place that, you know, I'd never thought I would be at, honestly, in January 2017. So mm-hmm. 3 years later, 4 years later, mm-hmm. how many years?
Almost four. Yeah, it'll be four next month.
Four years later, I am alive and I am mm-hmm. kicking and I'm doing really, really well. So thank
you. Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. Thanks for listening to Defy. We really appreciate your support and we hope that you listen to all of the different podcasts that we've put together. And guess what? We're available on all of the podcast platforms and on social media too. And we even have a website. Like seriously, we have all of that stuff. You can find us at www.defy.community. You can find us on Instagram at defy.comm, on Facebook using the same defy.comm, or you can even send me an email if you just want to chat about something or if you have an idea of a podcast that you think would be really great for our community. Our email is contact@defy.community. We hope that you have found something that you can take away from this podcast that will impact your life. We hope that you continue to defy society's expectations of you because remember, baby, well-behaved women rarely make history.